then he flies off the earth and kills him. So what can happen to you? Any comments to it? There's a bit of Squiggly Puddle. Okay, that's probably true. What if you were caught? What could happen to you? What can happen to you? Any volunteers? If the act of sabotage is a completely different question. Because actually, we don't have the full information really about what's going on. All right, we'll park that for a minute and come back to it. If you've been here in the evenings the last few weeks, you'll have known that we're reading through Joshua, which is all about how the tribes of the Israelites entered into the promised land, promised to Abraham generations before, and it tells the story of how they took that land and settled it. And I'm going to need to draw some circles of context for you so that we can try and get hold of what's here in the middle of Joshua and why it matters within the Old Testament and why it matters within the larger plan of God. So, first of all, the book of Joshua. I wonder if I can see. Is it this button at the top or where I turn it off? So the book of Joshua fits within the larger context in the Old Testament here, which is dominated by the promise to Abraham. We're looking at Abraham in our morning services at the moment. The promise to Abraham is found in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 to 3. And let me just quickly read that to you. Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 to 3. Said to Abram, go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all the peoples on earth will be blessed through you. An amazing promise to Abraham, which finally, in the days of Joshua, generations later, is beginning to come into being. And time and time again, the way the book of Joshua describes what is happening here is that it is an inheritance. The tribes of Israel are inheriting the promise to their forefather Abraham in Genesis 12. I had a rough count yesterday and found that the word inheritance appears about 50 times in the book of Joshua. Finally, after years and years and generations, they are being given by God the inheritance which was promised centuries before. So the book of Joshua fits within the context of the Old Testament, dominated by the promise to Abraham. But we also need to add this other circle of context as well, around the edge. Because the way we understand the Old Testament, when we open the Bible, the way we understand it really should be sure you know, is it consistently points to Jesus as the one who brings to completion, the one who fulfills what we find in the Old Testament. And so it isn't by accident that the New Testament draws on the Joshua language of inheritance to describe what we have in Jesus. So inheritance is what you find in Joshua. This is to describe the fulfillment of the promise to Abraham. And then you come to the New Testament, and it again talks about inheritance to describe what we have in Jesus. So 1 Peter 1, verses 3 and 4. I think I've got this one on the screen. Yeah, here we are. Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. In his great mercy, he has given us new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. And into an inheritance, deliberately chosen that word to echo the inheritance word of the Old Testament. An inheritance that can never perish, spoil or fail, kept in heaven for you. So, what we should expect as we read the book of Joshua is that we should find pointers in different ways to Jesus, who is the one who ultimately fulfills that promise to Abraham, bringing blessing to all the peoples on the earth. What has that got to do with an act? Well, the book of Joshua shows us how the tribes of Israel change from being a nomadic society, moving around and living in different places from month to month, year to year. How they change from that to being a settled society, living in a land. And with that change come opportunities to modify how you administer justice. I do promise you, well, I hope I promise you, this is all going to tie up amazing. If you go all the way back to Genesis chapter 9, you find this very basically stated principle of justice. Whoever sheds human blood, by human shall their blood be shed, for in the image of God, as God made mankind. Whoever sheds human blood, by human shall their blood be shed, for in the image of God, as God made humankind. What they're saying is that human life is so precious, human life is so sanctified, that someone who kills someone else should themselves be put to death. I mean, it's a provisional law. It's not for all time, as we'll see. But the point that it's making is that killing someone is not something that should be overlooked. According to Genesis chapter 9, verse 6, it should be met with a penalty which is equivalent to the crime. It should be met with a penalty which is the death of the killer. Now, at the moment, we are in this country in the midst of what feels like an epidemic of knife crime. I need to pray about that. 41 fatal stabbings this year. I think it's been 5 fatal stabbings in London just in the last week, and there's been several in West Sydney in the last few weeks. And it's an issue which I know resonates in this community here. Life is precious. Life is sanctified. For in the image of God, as God made mankind, something quite terrible is happening in our nation, and we need to bring that to God in prayer. Back in Genesis, at the beginning of the Bible, the question arises to how this form of justice should be administered. So if a killer should himself be put to death, according to this, how do you do that in a nomadic society? If you go all the way back to a nomadic society, how do you administer justice like this? Who is it taking the life of the killer or enacting justice. And it seems that what happened was that it generally fell to somebody who is called the Goel Hadam in Hebrew, the Goel Hadam, the Avenger of Blood. And you find this referenced in several places in the Old Testament, the Avenger of Blood, the Goel Hadam, including in Joshua, the Avenger of Blood was the one who was supposed to administer justice. And by and large, this was a relative of the person who had been killed. So, if I were to kill your brother, then you could act as the Avenger of Blood, and it would represent justice, according to this, for you to kill me. No courts get needed, no judge, no jury. That was the way it worked. You had an Avenger of Blood. And it sounds merciless, and maybe it was. But ironically, it was a system which was supposed to underscore the value of human life. You can't kill someone and for that to be overlooked. Well, it was quite merciless, but you see, moving from a nomadic society to a settled one, where you are in a land, which is what happens in the book of Joshua, it means that changes can arise to the way that justice is done. And God reveals changes in the yellow section, reveals changes here in the book of Joshua, which will have echoes out into the wider plan. You'll see some changes to the way the principles of justice are administered, and they will then echo out into a wider plan of God. So each week, so far, we've read a fairly small chunk of Joshua. Each week, we've read a chunk of Jericho and other places and battles. And I didn't want to invite anyone to come and read chapters 12 to 21, because it'll take a long time. But I can talk you through 12 to 21 quite quickly if you pick up a Bible. And I can give you just a brief guided tour. We've been following the Israelites as they've entered the Promised Land and as they've engaged in some of those battles. And so then in chapter 12, you only need to glance at it, and you can see I'm in Genesis here. I'm wondering why it's not really what I expected. Joshua. I'm talking about Joshua, chapter 12. If you just glance at that chapter, you can see that it is a list of kings that the Israelites have deposed. King of king of king is listed. And then after chapter 12, what we are told is summarized very nicely by this map. Always good to have a map. It tells us the middle chunk of Joshua where the different tribes settled in the land. So if you look at chapter 13, you can see that it talks about the tribes which get the land on the east side of the River Jordan here. So Manasseh gets part of Manasseh gets some territory on the east, the tribe of Gad and the tribe of Reuben get land on the east side. That's chapter 13. Chapter 14 tells us specifically what happened to Caleb. Do you remember who Caleb was? Any volunteers from Caleb? Yes, one of the spies. He went spying with Joshua, one of the two faithful. He said, yes, we can take this land. So there's a chapter to Caleb, and Caleb is given the city of Hebron. Now here, that is chapter 14. See how fast we're going. Chapter 15 tells us in great detail the boundaries given to the tribe of Judah. Down here. That is chapter 15. Chapter 16 and chapter 17 together talk about the other half of the tribe of Manasseh and the tribe of Ephraim and the land that they get. And that leaves seven tribes left. And chapter 18 tells us about Benjamin. Here's Benjamin here. He is chapter 18, his tribe. And then chapter 19 tells us about Simeon, Zebulun, Issachar, Asher, Naphtali, and Dan. Chapter 19, nice and quick. And so now all of the tribes have got some land, except for one tribe, the tribe of Levi. The Levites, as priests, they get land themselves. But chapter 21 tells us how they were settled in different towns across the land. Now, is everybody happy with the maths here? How many tribes of Israel are there? 12. So let us count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And the tribe of Levi, who has no land, 13. 12 tribes of Israel. Is that all right? You happy? Do you know why? I see your lips mouthing the name Joseph. The tribes are named after the sons of Jacob, but Joseph's sons are Ephraim and Manasseh. And so these are the Joseph tribes. And so whilst Levi gets no land, Joseph's sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, get land each. And that's how that works. Is that all right? Good. Right. So at that point, you could pretty much say that the ancient promise to Abraham was fulfilled. And that is really more or less what the author of the book of Joshua says at the end of chapter 21. Let me read the end of chapter 21 for you. So the Lord gave Israel all the land he had sworn to give their ancestors, and they took possession of it and settled there. The Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he had sworn to their ancestors. Not one of their enemies withstood them. The Lord gave all their enemies into their hands. Not one of all the Lord's good promises to Israel failed. Everyone was fulfilled. The message of Joshua is our God is a faithful God. God fulfills his promise. God promised the land. And here it is. They have it. God promised the nation. And here they are constituted as tribes within the nation. I wonder if I could just give you one more job. And ask you to look back at that promise in Genesis 12, verses 1 and 1 to 3. And see if you could spot which bit of the promise there we haven't covered in our survey of Joshua 12:21. So have a look at Genesis 12:1-3 and see what's promised to Abraham. And see if you can spot what elements of it we haven't covered as we've gone through 12:21 Joshua. Jumping out. Blessing in the curses. The blessing, particularly the blessing into the nation. So Abraham has promised a land, promised that it will be a nation, and promised that all the peoples of earth will be blessed through him. What we've seen in Joshua is that they've got a land, so they've been constituted as a nation, but where are the peoples of the earth? Where are the peoples of the nation? Where is the blessing that comes to them? Well, this is where chapter 20 comes in. And I've been thinking this week that maybe Joshua chapter 20 is the most important chapter in the book. And I'm surprised that I've never given it any credit before in the past. And it is also connected to the puzzle about the axe. So the threads start to come together. Does anybody feel brave enough just to come up here and read chapter 20 to us? Thank you, Andrew. It's Andrew, isn't it? Andrew's going to read for us chapter 20. Anyone who kills a person accidentally and unintentionally may flee there and find protection from the avenger of blood. When they flee to one of these cities, they are to stand at the entrance of the city gate and state their case before the elders of that city. Then the elders are to admit the fugitive into their city and provide a place to live among them. If the avenger of blood comes in pursuit, the elders must not surrender the fugitive, because the fugitive kills their neighbour unintentionally and without malice aforethought. They are to stay in that city until they have stood trial before the assembly and until the death of the high priest who is serving at that time. Then they go back to their own home in the town from which they came. So they set apart Kadesh in Galilee, in the hill country of Nazareth, Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim, and Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the hill country of Judah. East of the Jordan, on the other side from Jericho, they designated Bezer in the wilderness on the plateau in the tribe of Reuben, Ramoth in Gilead in the tribe of Gad, and Golan in Bashan in the tribe of Manasseh. Any of the Israelites or any foreigner residing among them who killed anyone accidentally could flee three designated cities and not be killed by the avenger of blood prior to standing trial before the assembly. So you're with it. There are going to be six cities of refuge. Six cities of refuge. And they were in the north and in the centre and in the south, and they were both on the west side and the east side of the Jordan. Look at where the places are on the map. They are six cities covering the land, cities of refuge. And if you were accidentally responsible for some of these deaths, you could flee to one of those cities. And it wasn't because of a get out of jail free card. They weren't there so that you could commit murder and you could get away with it. You had to state your case before the elders on arrival in verse 4, and you had to stand trial as well in verse 6. But if it was deemed that you had caused the death accidentally, then you could stay in the city and you could not be handed over to the avenger of blood, whoever that may be. So this introduces a strong note of mercy into the system of justice that wasn't there before. And it's something that God had planned a long, long time before and had announced to Moses way back before Joshua's time. I'm just going to read you another bit of the Bible. This is chapter 19 of Deuteronomy. So this is set years before Joshua's time, when on the verge of the promised land, and God is giving instructions to Moses. I don't have it on the screen. Let me just read it to you. This is Deuteronomy 19. When the Lord your God has destroyed the nations whose land he has given you, and when you have driven them out and settled in their towns and houses, then set aside for yourselves three cities in the land the Lord your God has given you to possess. Determine the distances involved and divide into three parts of the land the Lord your God has given you as an inheritance, so that a person who kills someone may flee for refuge to one of these cities. This is the rule concerning anyone who kills a person and flees there for safety. Anyone who kills a neighbor unintentionally without malice aforethought. For instance, a man may go into the forest with his neighbor to cut wood, and as he swings his axe to fell a tree, the head may fly off and hit his neighbor and kill him. That man may flee to one of these cities and save his life. Otherwise, the avenger of blood might pursue him in a rage overtake him at the distance of 2 days and kill him, even though he is not deserving of death, since he did it to his neighbor without malice or forethought. This is why I command you to set aside for yourself 3 cities. So, moving from being a nomadic society to a settled society, God introduces a note of mercy into the system of justice. There are cities of refuge now commanded in Moses 3, and actually they set up 6. You could flee there, you could find refuge there. Refuge in the city of refuge. Nevertheless, because someone had died, and because his life was precious, you weren't free. You might have refuge in one of these cities, but you were still in exile. You couldn't leave the city, or you would be fair game to the Avenger of Blood. Now, these cities were at one and the same time places of refuge and places of exile. If you were admitted to one of these cities, you were in exile for the rest of your life. Apart from, and this is very odd and very striking, you could be free on only one condition. And I wonder if you can see that in Joshua 20, verse 6. The one condition that would set you free from the exile that you are in. Now you can search the Old Testament high and low for a reason for this, and you won't find a reason for this. I could speculate, but I cannot tell you the reasons for sure. What I do know is that woven into the fabric of God's promise is freedom from exile only on the death of the high priest. And this provision is there for you, not only if you are an Israelite, not only if you are a member of one of these Israelite tribes. The provision is for all of the Israelites, and verse 9, for any foreigner who lives among them. The gate of God's mercy has been opened to all. And this is really where we must return to this all the time as we read the Old Testament. Because what we find in the Old Testament points us forward to the ultimate justice and the ultimate mercy of God found in Jesus. I can't explain why this is woven into the fabric of God's promise in the Old Testament. Jesus is our high priest. See? Hebrews 2, verse 17. For this reason, he had to be made fully human in every way, in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest